The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good morning, everyone. Is this loud enough for people to hear? Great. So, this morning I want to talk about mindfulness of thinking. And it's one of the important areas of practice, because thinking is often the source of tremendous amount of suffering. Too much rumination is one of the causes of stress in people's lives. And I find it kind of fascinating to look at thinking, to consider it, and maybe represented by the silly statement that you can think about thinking. And this way in which it kind of can reflect back on itself makes it both kind of amusing sometimes, kind of tantalizing, and also sometimes elusive, that you know, once you start thinking about it, what is it, and how do we look at it, and kind of sometimes slips away. But it's probably fair to say that for many people, thinking is kind of like the water that fish swim in, and they say that water, that fish don't realize they're in water. I don't know if that's true, but they don't see the water they're in. And many times I think people don't really appreciate how much we're swimming in an ocean of thoughts and ideas and concepts, and how much the central role they have in our lives. And so to take a good look at them is very useful. For the purposes of meditation, one of the reasons to look at thinking, to consider it, is in order to have access to a still mind, access to a peacefulness, a peacefulness which is in between your thoughts or in a different place than your thinking, maybe like the container for the thinking, because it's possible to have a peaceful mind and then to think peacefully, as opposed to think anxiously or whatever. And so to take a good look at thinking is a fascinating thing. Many years ago, there was a woman who came to a retreat I was teaching, and she was asked, "Why are you here? Why have you come back to retreat?" And she said, "Oh, I had to come back because at the last retreat, for the first time in my life, I really saw my thinking. I saw my thinking in a clear, more distinct way than I ever had before. And I had to come back to see if I can discover where those thoughts come from." Good luck. But, you know, where do thoughts arise from? Where do they come from? What are they? What are these things that we call thoughts and thinking? And how do we think? Different people think in different ways. There are different kinds of thoughts that we have, different ways of thinking. And how we think shifts and changes over the day or over time. And some people think more in images. Some people think more in words. Some people do a combination of both. At different times, some people, there's a lot of discursive thinking, commentarial thinking, a lot of very active, high-end thinking. And other people, the thinking is, they almost don't know they're thinking because they don't think in words so much or even in images. It's more felt sense or just a knowing that's there. There's different ways of thinking. I read recently of a study that was done where they compared people who had done mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, people who had had depression. And they had one group of people, they did mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, and the other group they gave Paxil to, an antidepressant. And both people apparently benefited about the same from both. So that was interesting. But what was more interesting was they did brain scans of their brain activity. And what they discovered was that, what they expected was that the brain scans would show that the same brain centers shifted in activity in the same way for both Paxil and for mindfulness. And what they found was the opposite. They found that the frontal cortex, where there's a higher level thinking and rumination goes on, got quieter for people who did mindfulness and got more active for people on Paxil. And the limbic system and the hippocampus, which is more to do with the emotional centers of the brain, they got more active for people doing mindfulness and less active for people on Paxil. So kind of reversed, even though the result was the same. And so it isn't that the people who are mindful became, you know, I don't know, dull-witted because they because, you know, their thinking centers were quieting down. But rather, I think that the ways in which we kind of spin around in thoughts, they affect, certainly can have a big impact on us. But if we can think clearer and more actively, then sometimes we can cut through some of the depression. But also, if we can, another way of cut through depression is to stop all those ruminations. Quiet down. Don't think better about them. And don't recontextualize them, as they often do in cognitive therapy. But learn how not to be caught in the ocean of thinking and thoughts, and have that become quieter and peaceful. And we don't become dull-witted because of that, but I think then we have access to greater sources of creativity within us. And one of the things that studies have shown is that creativity often comes from a quiet mind than it does come from an overcrowded mind that's full of concerns and worries and thoughts. And then the effect that the emotional centers got stronger with mindfulness, I think emotions are great. And we don't want to dull those down. But again, which emotions come to the forefront? And I think that as the thinking becomes more settled or calmer, we're more likely to have more positive emotions. When we're lost in a sea of thoughts, rumination, spinning out, it tends to be fueled by anxious thoughts or desire thoughts or anger thoughts, emotions which are not really that healthy to be in. So, you know, that was an interesting study. So the idea of quieting the mind and having some taste of the still mind or the peaceful mind is a possibility if we get wise about the nature of our thinking and how we think. Some people associate meditation with the idea that you're supposed to stop thinking, and so they try. So I read also a study where they gave two groups of people, and they told them both to think about white bears. No, told one group, think about white bears, polar bears. And the other one group, they said, don't think about white polar bears. And then somehow, in the study, they're able to. I guess they talked to them 5 minutes after this little exercise started, and then quantify who thought most about the polar bears. Guess who had the most thoughts about it? The people who were told not to think about it. And so the idea, you know, be told don't think, can be quite counterproductive, I believe. What's more interesting is to be relaxed about our thoughts. But to bring mindfulness to it, curiosity, interest to that. There's something about bringing interest to the world of thinking, which is brings a different perspective on thoughts that feeds investigation, feeds curiosity, as opposed to feeding the thinking itself. If we're resisting the thoughts, oddly enough, that often feeds the thinking, feeds that part of us that's engaged, that produces thoughts. But if we simply look at it and are aware of it, that brings it, kind of activates a different part of the mind. I would like to suggest that it activates a quieter part of the mind. So that we're kind of looking as opposed to reacting to it. Just simple. Just look. What is this? What is this thoughts? And then as people look at thoughts, then you can find out something about the nature of your thinking. How do you think? What goes on with you when you think? What is this species, or maybe it's more than species, this zoo of different animals in there, there's different ways we have of thinking. What is it for you? And it's hard to look at it objectively because of the very powerful way and we get pulled into it. And we kind of become the thoughts, or we kind of see through the filter of the thinking, as opposed to stand outside. It's like going into the cage in the zoo to study the animal, and then, you know, if it's the lion or the polar bears, be, you know, in the cage, you're not going to be watching your thoughts very much. But if you're outside, then you can kind of see, you know, more objectively. So to find some way to kind of, what is this? What goes on? And so one of the things to look at, consider, is how much energy do you expend in your thinking? Thinking can be exhausting. And there can be, you can feel maybe the blood flows to your brain sometimes, the muscles in your forehead tighten up and the capillaries tighten up and you get headaches. There's all this energy and activity that can go in to thinking. Sometimes a variety of muscles in your body tighten up when there's a lot of thinking going on. A common one for some people is the jaw. Some people is the shoulders. Sometimes the chest tightens up, the stomach, different places. Some people feel it in their hands quite a bit when they, some people you can see when they really, really preoccupied with something, their hands are kind of playing with their fingers a lot. And so when there's a lot of energy around thinking, it's exhausting and tiring. So you can notice what kind of thinking is this kind of very activated kind of thinking. And then to start noticing those times in your life when the thinking is not so energetic and the thinking is quiet and settled. Almost like there's no energy, effort at all to have those thoughts. The image in Buddhism is have thoughts like clouds drifting in an endless sky. A thought just arises, it's there, it goes by. If you're laying in, you know, on a nice grass lawn, in a nice, refreshing summer day, and you're looking up at the clouds drifting by, you know, it's so relaxing and peaceful and captivating in a nice way. Just kind of go there and drift by. And so the same, it's possible to have a thought arise in the mind, and it just to go, you know, just arises peacefully, it floats by, and we watch it. So it doesn't have to be that dramatic that you have it, but to, for you to be in seeing the contrast between different ways of thinking, different kinds of energetic ways of thinking is very helpful. The other thing to notice about thinking is this question this woman asked on retreat, where do they come from? Where do thoughts arise out of? Because if thinking is going on furiously and fast, it's very easy to take credit for your thinking or to feel like you are your thoughts, that you're somehow in the nexus of your thinking. But are you really in charge of your thoughts? Who's in charge of your thoughts? Where do the thoughts arise from? How do they appear in the first place? It's relatively easy for me to plant a thought in your mind. I think I can get you to think something against your will. So you can cover your ears if you don't want to, but this is you know, very innocuous. So you're not gonna be troubled, I think, forever now. But if I say something like, the hills are alive with the sound of, you know, or this year we have a presidential candidate whose name is Donald. Do you fill in the rest? And you were here minding your own business at IMC this morning and didn't have anything, the word music wasn't occurring to you at all, or presidential candidates weren't occurring to you. And then suddenly this, you know, I say something and you make the association and the thought arises. Where does that come from? You know, who's in charge in there? Am I in charge of you? I don't say that I'm in charge, but are you in charge? Who's in charge of where these things come from? You know, this is maybe kind of a silly little example, this one, but here's an interesting thing. If the mind gets really, really quiet, like in meditation, I only know this happens in meditation, this ability for some people. It gets really, really quiet, so there's almost no thoughts at all. And in a long period of no thinking. But your mind is very attentive, watching, very present. And then some people report it this way. It's like the surface of a water, and there starts arising a bubble out of that water. But because the mindfulness is strong, the person's right there and sees the bubble arise. And because we're seeing the bubble arise, it just dissolves and goes back into wherever it came from. And that bubble was the arising of a thought. But because it dissolved, because before it left, you know, the thought bubble left the surface of the water, you never know what that thought was going to be. I mean, maybe it was an important thought. You know, lottery numbers, you know, the great American novel. Who knows, you know, what you missed out on. You know, probably if your track record is of always having wonderful thoughts, you might have missed out the very important one. But I don't know what your track record is for the quality of your thoughts. But the important thing is, though, here at this point, is you can watch it come up. It begins to arise outside of consciousness, outside of the places where we know what it's about. And if the beginning of a thought happens off stage, you know, where is it coming from and who's in charge here? And how much sense does it take to identify with a thought as being mine or that I'm responsible for it? It's fascinating to watch. Oh, just, what is this? Are these thoughts that we have? Where do they come from? So as we study thinking and thoughts, it's possible to notice all the ways in which thinking has strings that spread out and are tied up with other parts of our psychophysical being. That those strings or those connections are strong to our emotional life. They're strong to our physical life, to the life of our beliefs, to the life of our memories, the associations we have. And it's possible to see how when a thought arises or thinking about a particular thing, how those strings are both tugging at these different places like a puppeteer, but also get tugged in return. There's a mutual relationship back and forth. So, for example, I might be thinking about something important, and I might have anxiety about it. And the anxiety is, you can feel the connection between the thinking and the anxiety. And you can not only that, but it's possible to see the way they reinforce each other. That when I think certain thoughts, anxiety arises. When anxiety is there, I become more interested in those thoughts. I become alarmed, I'm very concerned about it. And sometimes it becomes a loop that gets stronger and stronger, and some people have panic attacks at the end because of this loop between anxiety and the thoughts they have. We can frighten ourselves in our thoughts. There was a story of a Chinese painter in the old days who was painting a very realistic tiger and then on the canvas, and then stepped back to admire his work. And when he saw it from a distance, he got afraid and ran away. You know, you kind of so realistic. So sometimes, you know, we have these thoughts and we kind of get scared, and but we can't really run that far, so then there's this loop. So this connection between our emotions and thinking is very important because emotions sometimes are the fuel that keeps our thinking going. And if we simply let go of the thought, but the fuel is still there, the factory for them is still there, the factory of emotion is going to pump out more thoughts. And so it just kind of continues for a long time. So a very important part of mindfulness practice then is to go look and see what is the emotion that's there, and then bring a simple, relaxed attention to the emotion that's connected to the thinking. And that sometimes settles things down. And then the thinking sometimes recedes to the background, because the thinking is really a secondary thing sometimes. When emotions are at the heart of it. Emotions are kind of maybe what really needs attention. If we keep giving attention to the thinking, sometimes it's easy to keep thinking even more and more. The other string is very important, is the way that our thinking is tied to our physical body, as I mentioned earlier. And there's a variety of places we can get tense if there's a lot of active thinking going on. And so one of the arts of meditation is learning to identify the places in the body that are an expression or energetically a place where the thinking kind of manifests, and learn to relax that. So relaxing around the eyes and the forehead, relaxing the stomach or the shoulders, a variety of places where we can feel the tension of thinking and learn to relax it. Because if we don't relax the physical tension connected to thinking, it's again fuel for more thinking. And so we kind of, all the conditions are there to think more. I don't know if this is a good analogy, but it's kind of like if you squeeze your toothpaste and the cap is off, it squirts out, it comes out. And so, and if you squeeze it, you keep squeezing it, eventually all come out. So, but if you want to stop all that toothpaste from coming out, you have to release your hand, the tension in your hand, stop squeezing it. So if your body is all being squeezed, guess what gets squeezed out? More thoughts. But if you can relax that tension, there's a relaxation of energy, and the energy that feeds the thinking, and the thinking can quiet down. So I suspect that for most people, there is some place in their body that they can identify as the primary place where thinking manifests or affects in terms of tension or energy. Sometimes it's posture. And if you pay attention to your posture, you see that when you think certain things, your posture takes certain form. Sadness and depression, your posture slumps, for example. Or some certain kinds of anxiety, and we're kind of hyper alert. The eyes open up wide. So to kind of notice what your pattern is. And if you know where your pattern is, that gives you a little bit quicker access to notice where the tension is. You say, oh, it's in my eyes. Oh, it's in my shoulders or my jaw. Let me look there and see what's going on. For some people, it's possible to feel tension or pressure or tightness in the area where we generally say the brain is. So in the forehead and between the ears, somehow up in that kind of place where the brain, there's maybe a lot of blood that's flowing there, maybe, it feels tense, it feels like pressure. And it's almost as if the brain is a thinking muscle, and in order to quiet the thinking down, it helps to identify the pressure and tension that's there, and then relax it, soften it. Soften the pressure. To try to deal with the thinking head on in terms of, making it go away or making it stop is very hard if there's all this pressure and tension there squeezing the toothpaste out. So the thinking muscle in the brain, let that relax and soften. I find it useful to have an image when I do that. And that image is, I take the thinking muscle of the brain wherever when I feel a lot of pressure up there, and imagine that as I relax it, it's spreading out like a wave on an ocean, and it's spreading down and flattening out and spreads out horizontally really far and becomes a still, quiet surface of an ocean or a lake. And just that image helps me kind of with the quieting down of the thinking mind. As the thinking mind gets quieter, then it becomes an opportunity for a fascinating and very important aspect of Vipassana practice. And that is, it's possible to notice that individual thoughts you have vanish, temporarily at least. They kind of stop. And there's maybe a kind of a gap before they start up again. Because if they're going on incessantly, one on top of the other, and there's no gap, then it just seems like it's claustrophobic in there, just lots of thoughts. But as we calm down and get relaxed, and as our powers of attention get stronger, it's possible to see that there's gaps in the thoughts, and they vanish. And then they come on again. And one of the nice things about this is that in that, as we start seeing them vanish and re-arise, it's possible to notice better our relationship to those thoughts, how we're interested in them, how we're searching for them or leaning towards them, or how we're reacting to them and alarmed by them, or how we, I think I already said this, give authority to those thoughts, that we think they're really important. Thoughts are important, but we can over-invest in them and think that, you know, that all the life solution is going to come from them. And it's reasonable to do that, to have a lot of interest in thoughts as being problem solvers, because it seems like that's one of the functions of thinking, is to do the kind of associative reasoning and problem solving that we need to negotiate our life. But because our thoughts are often have kind of a problem-solving nature to them, there's a kind of an authority they have that they're going to provide solutions, they're going to provide answers that we need to have. And the track record for most of us, I don't want to speak for all of you, is that track record is probably that you don't get good answers that often. You probably don't, you know, like for me, I learned that at some point that I did a lot of planning, and planning is often fueled by anxiety. But and more importantly, I learned that my plans, I made a lot of plans about, you know, all kinds of things, what was going to happen in the day, the conversations I was going to have later in the day, what I was going to do, the here and there. And I learned that my track record for predicting the future was abysmal. I had it all planned out according to some scenario I thought it was going to unfold. And I would show up, and it was different than how I planned. And so my plans were not really helpful. And so I had to do that maybe 10,000 times before I finally dawned on me that I was wasting my time, that I probably had better things to do than plan when my planning proved unuseful. So when I kind of saw the, you know, how regularly I misplanned, I kind of started to quiet down and just was more content not to plan. And then I learned to just be more interested in just showing up and figuring out when that was appropriate. But as we quiet down and thoughts vanish and thoughts arise, we can start looking a little bit about the nature of the thoughts in a different way. Where do they arise out of? How personal are they? How much are we responsible for what the thoughts are that arise? Does it make sense to identify them and take possession of them? This is me. These are my thoughts. And they're not anybody else's thoughts, but they are it's possible to see them as clouds drifting through the sky. You know, if you cut your fingernail clippings, and I don't know if you've ever done this, and then looked at your fingernail clipping when it's laying on the, wherever you put it, or pick it up. Is that you? What are those clippings? You know, when they're still on the finger, before you cut your fingernails, you know, it's kind of you. Is it? But if you cut it off, what is it then? You go around and tell your friends, look at me, you know, look at my little clipping here. This is me. You know, it's like, you know, it's kind of the line between how we identify this is mine and this is me and this is not me is a little bit arbitrary. Same thing with thoughts. Some thoughts are just clippings that, you know, they're already, you know, maybe the fact that they've appeared means they've already been clipped off. And what's more important is what's deeper down. And so what is underneath the active, discursive, commentary mind? What's deeper than the mind that's reasoning? What's deeper than the mind that's planning and thinking and having conversations in its head? I find it fascinating to watch my mind all the time, but I find it fascinating to watch my mind and to watch how I process and know things. Know what to do, for example. So I was involved, for example, the other day doing dishes and putting the dishes after dinner into the dishwashing machine. And I noticed that I could put the dishes in the dishwashing machine without thinking about it actively, because I was thinking about other things. I was having a conversation, I was thinking about other things. And I just, there was just this knowing that the plates should go in, you know, in a particular way to be efficient and all that. And I just knew how to move, how to bend, how to place them in there. And there was no thinking, explicit thinking, obvious thinking involved, but there was knowing. There was a complicated mental processing going on. It's not an, you know, if you take someone from 30,000 years ago, 30,000 years ago, people were basically like us. They just had different clothes and probably hairstyles, but you know, their, you know, the mental functioning and their ability, intelligence was pretty similar in many ways, I think. Or, you know, 3,000 years ago or something. And you give them dirty dishes in a sink and a dishwasher without explaining anything. You know, they would like be fascinated and look at the shiny stuff and the smooth stuff and this funny thing that comes out of the, you know, out of the this silver thing that kind of has a little hook and comes out, and you know, they would touch it and they would know no idea what it's about, and the dishwashing machine, they'd be completely perplexed. And it would take a lot of learning, a lot of explaining. It's a complicated phenomena which our mind knows how to do because we've learned it and we've internalized it in such a way that areas of knowing, of processing, of maybe thinking, we can call it, but not conscious thinking, is operating below the obvious conscious level of thinking. And how much of our life operates out of that kind of subconscious place of knowing? What is this kind of knowing? That we can know something as complicated as putting things in a dishwashing machine, but doesn't require our conscious thought. How much of our life operates from that place? And I would propose that it's a very high percentage of our life, probably 99.999999% of our life, operates from that kind of knowing. Because there's a tremendous amount of things that we're processing all the time. And there's 0.1000001% of our life that we identify with as being me, myself, and mine. That I have to figure things out, I have to do things, it's up to me, it's, all this is happening to me. It's actually a very small sliver. And one of the things you can learn to do as the mind gets quieter, as we're not incessantly spinning out in thoughts, and there's more space between the arising and passing of thoughts, or more stillness or quiet in the mind, is that it's possible to have a stronger access to this deeper knowing that is the source sometimes of creativity, of deeper understanding and knowing, problem solving, a richness of life that can come alive. But we don't, you know, it doesn't come from the world of conscious thinking so much, but it comes from a deeper kind of place of knowing or processing, a silent knowing almost. And to appreciate that operates and how it operates, it can be very freeing. It can be very freeing because often some of the surface attachments we have often come with our thinking about things and concepts and ideas. But if we don't live so actively and fully in concepts and thoughts and ideas, then there's a lot of more freedom and ease that can happen as we move through. Thoughts, concepts, ideas, thinking are often abstractions that remove us and separate from the world. Like if we're thinking a lot about the past, we're thinking a lot about the future, we're not really fully here now. If we're here now, but we're caught up in our commentary and evaluations and judgments about what's happening now, it also kind of keeps us separate and removed from what's going on. But if that thinking mind no longer has prominence and becomes quieter, this more silent kind of knowing or the deeper kind of knowing that can operate often is much more likely to be in harmony and connected to what's happening here and now. And to allow the here and now and the deeper wellsprings of the mind to operate here and now is makes it possible to be much more peaceful and at ease. So to start appreciating all the knowing and processing and understanding that doesn't require a lot of thinking, that we do second nature. It's so obvious, so easy for us, because it's as easy as putting the dishes in the dishwashing machine. We don't think about it. But to appreciate how it operates, I find it kind of stunning and fascinating and awe-inspiring to be aware of how much amazing intelligence goes on in the human brain that I can't take credit for. It's just kind of like happening, and you can trust it. It's fascinating. And so this quieting of the emotional connection to thinking, settling it, calming it, calming and relaxing the physical connection to thinking, quieting it down, quieting the and settling our strong identification with thinking, our strong interest in the thoughts and fascination with them or alarm around them, the strong investment we have in thoughts that are going to provide the solution for our lives, to kind of quiet that down as well. And then to begin discovering that in this arising and passing, the vanishing and reappearing of thoughts, to start noticing there's a bigger world that goes on. There's a bigger world not only of processing, of knowing that goes on, but there's also a world of peace, of stillness. It would be a little bit like being in a room like here, and first you only notice all the people that are here, and maybe it feels crowded. But then you notice the space between the people. And then you notice, well, actually, there's a lot more space than there is people in here. And then you get interested in the space, and you look up, and we have a high ceiling. And there's a lot more space in here than there is people. And you notice the space itself is, in a certain kind of way, is peaceful, is still, is spacious. Creates a very different kind of feeling on the mind than if we're kind of jumping around evaluating people and am I safe here or who should I be with or we're having a potluck and, will people sit down and talk with me and, all kinds of, social kind of things going on. But if the mind quiets, opens up like this, there's peace. So the same way in the inner mind, when the thoughts quiet down, there's a lot of space in the mind. There's a lot of stillness in the mind, peacefulness in the mind, that's there on the side of thoughts, underneath thoughts, around thoughts, above thoughts, and all that. And the greater that peace and stillness is, the more space and room there is for some of the deeper knowing, deeper processing, deeper responsivity to the world to operate. It takes a certain degree of trust to be willing to relax enough and trust that place where we don't think so actively. Trust enough not to depend and try to get everything out of thinking. To let go of our confidence in thought as being the only place in which we navigate our world. Let our thinking quiet down, become still, stiller. And then we can think peacefully. Thinking is a wonderful thing. It's a wonderful tool. I'm very fond of my thinking. I don't have an adversarial relationship with my thoughts. But generally, I keep it in its right place. It doesn't have the upper hand. It doesn't run me. But I'm not troubled by my thoughts. They're like they come and they go. But I much more identify with kind of more the space of the mind or the peacefulness of the mind. Because that's a place where I feel life is much richer and fuller and much more of the inner processing, understanding, wisdom can arise out of and occur from. And the final thing I'd like to say about all this is it's as the practice, I think, gets stronger, there's a strong tendency to disidentify with thoughts, not be so enamored with our thinking. The thoughts still arise. You can see them arise. And this becomes, to see a thought arise, see a thought occur, to see a thought as just a thought and nothing more can give you a very important power. And this power is probably, I think, one of the most useful things that you have. And perhaps it's a power that is useful to identify. If you identify something as who you are, maybe this is more important than identifying with thoughts. And that is the power, the veto power. To say, I'm not going to go there. I'm not going to get interested in that. I'm not going to do that. Your mind can think all kinds of things. And we're not really responsible for what bubbles up and what thought arises. We are responsible for which thoughts we follow, which thoughts we pick up and get involved in. And so we do have the ability to say, somehow like, no. We do have the ability to kind of say, I'm not going to get involved with that. I'm going to let that be. I don't have to be aversive towards it, or not to be blame it, or be judgmental of it. I don't have to push it away. But it's a very simple, no, thank you. I'm not going to do that. No need. Sometimes if it's something deeper going on, it might reoccur, but then we still have the veto power. Nope, no thank you. Not, I don't have to do that. I don't have to be involved in that. And if we could use the veto power, then I think it's very strong, very safe to give freedom to the mind to think what it does, but not be in the danger of whatever we think forcing us to act on those thoughts, forcing us to believe on those thoughts. And this combination of giving freedom to the mind to think whatever it wants feels really good. Just let it think. And then saying no. I'm not picking that, I'm not going with that one. Just that's fascinating. It's interesting the mind would think that. Just let it the cloud drift on by, and I'm not gonna get on that cloud. Just let it be. And so it's a tremendous power to have that ability. And it's a power of peace. It's a power of freedom. It's a power of kind of keeping things spacious and peaceful in our inner life. Untroubled by what is going on in there. So I hope that this talk is a lot of thoughts. I hope all these thoughts I have about thinking are interesting for you. And one of the primary hopes I had in giving this talk is that, not that you remember everything I said, but that you would be more curious now about your thinking. And that you kind of would do kind of this 360-degree turn in your mind to look at thinking and understand it and see it for what it is, and in that curiosity and interest in where do thoughts come from? What is a thought? What is this? What's going on with I think? What is the source of these thoughts? What's going on here? What's the ecology of my thinking? That in that curiosity and interest that you will find greater freedom and greater peace in your life. So may you think happily. Thank you.